Our next guest has apparently created more viral videos than anyone else in the UK. And he doesn't rely on TikTok for that, nor in his life does he rely on luck. He creates that, or as much as he can. His areas of interest are to do with luck and the paranormal and deception, because before he became an academic, he was a magician. And his psychology-based YouTube videos have more than 500 million views. And he's consulted on TV shows like Mythbusters and worked with Darren Brown and Heston Blumenthal. Richard J. Wiseman is a professor of the public understanding of psychology at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK. One of his books is How Luck Happens. Another is The Luck Factor, the scientific study of the lucky mind. Hello, Richard.
Hello to you. Pleasure to be here.
I think we're lucky to get you, actually. You're a very busy bloke from the sounds of it.
Yes, it's always involved in quite a few projects, which is nice. Better to be busy than not to be busy.
Well, indeed. I want to ask you about luck in life, of course, but can we start with magic? I see on Twitter you've publicised a school in Cape Town that is nicknamed the Hogwarts of South Africa, and magic changed your life, which we'll get to. How can it change the lives of young people?
Oh, I think it has a huge potential. And the folks you're talking about there, the College of Magic, do a wonderful job changing the lives of children all over South Africa, and I think, but across the world and throughout, you know, history. I think magic, sometimes people just think, oh, you know, it's just some tricks, but it's far more than that. If you think about it, then kids are learning self-confidence. They're learning creativity. Magic tricks, the solutions tend to be pretty lateral. They're learning social skills. You have to obviously interact with people and show them the illusions. They're also learning flexibility, because I can tell you from firsthand experience, when you start to perform magic, things go wrong and you have to learn how to cope with that. And they're also learning to concentrate. You know, magic, if you're going to do it well, involves practicing. And all these things are absolutely key life skills. So you might think, you know, oh, you're teaching some tricks to some kids. You're doing far more than that. And it's potentially life-changing.
And it still entrances, doesn't it, judging by the hundreds of millions of views for your own videos. That's the thing. People are still enraptured by magic.
I think it has just this, you know, enduring appeal, the notion of something impossible happening right in front of you. And it's not like going to see a film or reading a book where you have to sort of suspend your disbelief. What's interesting about magic is you really have to believe it. You have to believe that the coin was placed into the magician's hand and that it disappears and that you have no explanation for that. That is the magical experience. And it's really quite a unique experience. And thank goodness, one that appeals to people, I think.
You worked with the magician David Copperfield on a new book on the history of magic, and he has the secret museum of magic on which he's spent squillions, which is truly a secret. It's not open to the public still.
That's right. So David's based in Vegas and still is doing many shows every day out there. It's an incredible show that he has. And then after that show finishes, he normally goes over to a very secret location in Las Vegas, which houses this enormous and splendid private collection of magic and probably the world's most important artifacts in terms of the history of magic there. And so what we've done in the book that's coming out very soon is to really give readers a sense of what it's like to go on that tour. It's a lavishly illustrated book that takes you through the history of magic, talks about Houdini, these other great magicians, the wonderful stories associated with their lives, and how magic often took them from really quite modest backgrounds into being global superstars. So it's about the transformative effect of magic. It's about the secret world of magic.
And the luck that magic brings. Since you first started writing and studying and opining on luck, Richard, all those years ago, have your opinions changed about how to get a luckier life at all?
No, not really. I mean, that was a project, the Psychology of Luck project. We started, I think, 20 years ago now, when I was interviewing people about key moments in their lives, you know, how they were in certain careers and with certain partners and so on. And people kept describing themselves as lucky or unlucky. And so we gathered together about 1,000 exceptionally lucky and unlucky people and put their lives under the microscope. And what we could see is, with the exception of some sorts of accidents and illnesses and so on, people were creating their own good and bad luck by the way they were thinking and behaving. And they didn't realize that. You know, they thought it was this magical force that was entering their lives. But you could see quite systematic differences between the groups. And so that became the Luck Factor book all those years ago, and still talking about it today. You know, so it's been a wonderful project to be involved in.
How do you measure luck? Because there are the old lucky, unlucky jokes that do the rounds. There's the Chinese proverb, call no man lucky till he's dead. You know, Kipling said triumph and disaster are both imposters. I'm sure you've heard all these. So how do you measure luck?
Well, the way we measured it, and I should make a distinction between chance and luck. So we are not talking about chance events. We're not talking about going to the casino and winning on roulette or buying a lottery ticket and so on. Those are chance events. There doesn't matter what's going on inside your head. You're not going to influence the outcome of those. It's nothing paranormal or supernatural. But when you think about luck in life, being in the right place at the right time, getting those lucky opportunities, those career breaks, bumping into somebody at a party who then turns out to be, you know, your perfect partner or whatever, those things are far more under our control than we realize. And it's those sorts of things that I think make for a lucky life.
I wasn't going to ask about casinos, but you've reminded me. I once talked to a man who ran a gambling addiction center, and he said that people often strike what is proverbially known as beginner's luck. There are strange things, he thought, that happen with luck in places like that, and it tends to run out. I suppose you've encountered these kinds of stories as well, though.
Well, yeah, we looked into that a little bit, and I think it's really hard to assess that, because if you go along and it's the first time, you know, you've tried something like that and you do well, then it becomes a really memorable event and you'll tell other people about it and the story grows and so on. If you go along and lose your money, as most people do in casinos, then you probably don't come home and tell your friends about it in quite such an elaborate fashion. When we looked at luck and the lottery, there was no difference in the winning sort of probabilities of our lucky and unlucky people. The only difference was the lucky people tended to buy a ticket, tended to buy more tickets and increase their odds that way. Actually, not by very much, but still that's what they were doing.
Are you lucky? I mean, you seem to be.
I think I've been lucky in many ways. I mean, part of it is that when you work, as I did for so long, with these sort of groups of exceptionally lucky people, it's difficult for some of their optimism and their ways of thinking not to rub off on you. But also, for most of my career, you know, I've got to study the things that I find fascinating, that I've got a real passion for. So I got into magic when I was about 8 years old. It's still something that absolutely fascinates me, and I've carried out quite a lot of research into that. You know, I think that's one of the formulas for happiness, isn't it? If you have a passion in life and can find a way of making a living indulging yourself, then that's probably a pretty good way of being happy.
How much depends on extroversion? Because lucky people, as you found, score significantly higher on that. This makes them more open, more relaxed, less anxious. Anxiety blinds us to opportunities, or we may not believe we can handle them, I suppose. How much comes down to those kinds of genetics?
Well, genetics is kind of a thorny issue within psychology. So certainly some of our personality and psychological makeup is genetic. Most of it isn't. And I'm interested as a social psychologist in the bit that isn't, that is therefore malleable and can be improved and so on. In terms of extroversion, when we were conducting the research initially, and so we're going back, you know, 10, 20 years, certainly the extroverts had a much wider social circle. They simply knew more people, which meant more opportunities came their way. And perhaps more importantly, when things didn't work out well for them, there was a network there to help them out. Now, over time, that's changed, because the internet means that folks who don't enjoy social gatherings quite so much can still form that protective bubble around them. So I think that has changed over time. In terms of some of the other things you're talking about there, they have stood the test of time. So, for example, when you look at the world, how anxious you are really does determine how you see the world. When we become very anxious and very worried, we just focus in on what we think is important. The lucky people tended to be more relaxed, more cheerful, and so open to different ways of seeing what's out there. And so it's like they knew their destination, but they were still going to kind of use the wind direction, as it were, to sail towards that. The wind was blowing in one direction, they would change tack and go in that direction. It's also about flexibility. So the unlucky people tended to be stuck in a rut. So when an opportunity came along, they were just kind of reluctant to embrace it. So yeah, those sorts of things have stood the test of time.
And you ran a luck school. You see, there'll be a lot of people listening who are introverted or anxious or whatever, and you found that actually that stops you seeing things in the world quite literally, and you or opportunities. You ran a luck school. You put people through a series of exercises to increase their luck. What did you find?
Well, we found, first of all, that people can change, which is absolutely key. Second, that they can change across the board in terms of, income and longevity of relationships and health and so on. And third, most important of all, is that that change was often the result of small interventions. So if you take something like what we call the luck diary, we are creatures that habituate to our surroundings really quickly. So if you go into, say you like the smell of coffee and you go into a coffee shop, it smells great for 10 minutes, but then you get used to it and you have to come out to go back in again to get the same experience. And that same notion applies to our friends and family, our health, our careers, and so on. We get used to what we have and we always want more rather than perhaps having a sense of gratitude for what we've got. So with the luck diary, which was one of our simplest interventions, each night people spend about 30, 40 seconds just jotting down either something they're very grateful for in their lives, something that's worked out well that day, or a negative thing which used to happen in their life that no longer happens. And what that does is really focus their minds on the positive. So we're not saying to people, oh, just cheer up. It's not terrible advice to give to somebody. However, that exercise does change the way in which you see your life. It does make you more optimistic. It does make you feel better. And that's what we're interested in. That's what underpinned Luck School, exercises that were quick, that were easy, but that worked.
And a simple example from your luck school, as I understand it, is that when you go from complaining about scraping your knee to being grateful it wasn't any worse, you didn't break your leg, it becomes easier to try new things somehow.
Absolutely. I mean, it has all sorts of impacts, actually, because you start to see yourself in a more positive light. I mean, one of the problems with seeing yourself as unlucky is that you tend to think that everything will work out badly for you, no matter what the domain is. It will work out badly in your love life, in your career, and so on. And it's a very fatalistic belief. So just knowing that you can change is quite empowering for people. And the truth is, when we ran these diary studies where we got people to write down events in their lives for over a long period of time, we could see that no one got through unscathed. Bad things happened to everyone, including our lucky people, but they were very resilient. So I can remember interviewing a lucky person. I did the interview twice. By the time they came in for the second interview, they'd fallen down the stairs and broken their leg and came in with their leg in a cast. And I said, well, perhaps you don't consider yourself quite so lucky now. And they said, you're kidding. They said, this might be the best thing that ever happens to me. They said, last time I went into hospital, I met a nurse there. We fell in love. We've been married 20 years. It was the greatest thing ever. You never, ever know. And it's that attitude, not that it's an accurate attitude, but it's that attitude that will make you resilient. Bad things happen to everyone. That's often not under your control. What's under your control is whether you bounce back from that.
Okay, so it's a kind of magic. You teach people to see the world in a different, with a different pair of glasses on. Can this change of attitude last, persist in people, or do they return to being Eeyore-ish after a while, do you think?
It really depends. So before we did Luck School, we monitored the cohort for about a decade, and we didn't see any change. The unlucky people remained unlucky, the lucky ones remained lucky. When we did our intervention, we then monitored them for about a year, and the changes we saw from Luck School sustained over that time. We don't know past then. And we shouldn't kind of be too blaming of people who are unlucky. Often they do experience difficult life events, can be down to all sorts of factors. And if those factors become overwhelming, it's not surprising they would then go back to seeing themselves as unlucky. And also, there will be natural limits on this. It's not like everyone can be amazingly lucky. What we're trying to do is get people to be the best that they could be, given their circumstances, you know, given their psychological makeup and so on. And I think the key message here is that change is possible. We're not going to be the same person in a few years' time. So change and belief in change is at the absolute root of Luck School.
And I suppose even if you are feeling awkward about trying to widen your horizons and relax in life and look for opportunities, even just trying to be a bit friendlier in the office and going to that party you don't want to go to, even small steps can probably help.
Absolutely. So when it comes to flexibility, for example, a colleague of mine has carried out quite a lot of research into what he calls do something different. And so small things, you know, taking a different route to work, for example, watching films that you don't think you're going to enjoy, trying to, if you go to a restaurant, a different type of food you don't normally try, rearranging your furniture. All those things make you see yourself as a flexible person. So when an opportunity comes along, you're far more likely to embrace it. So I'm never a huge fan of people, you know, undertaking big lifestyle changes. Sometimes that works out well, sometimes it doesn't. But you know, often it's the small stuff, the sorts of things I've been talking about, that can have a surprisingly large impact.
Professor Richard Wiseman is with us. It's interesting that I think you're a fan of listening to your gut, your intuition, because various academics or psychologists regularly chime in on this, and often at polar opposites on this. And there was a well-read Harvard Review piece I saw once, it said, don't listen to your first impulses. But I think you say do.
If you get that gut feeling that something is terribly right or terribly wrong, it's useful to listen to that. It doesn't mean you always act on it. If you meet somebody and you think something's not right here, then it's an alarm bell. It's a reason to pause and to investigate the situation further. Same with an opportunity. You know, if it feels too good to be true, it might be. But still, you know, you think, okay, this is a good thing. Let me explore further. What we found with the unlucky people is often they either didn't have those intuitive feelings, which was kind of interesting, or when they did, they ignored them completely. They tended to overanalyze the situation. And by the time they'd come out with a plan, the whole world had moved on and their plan was out of date. The lucky people tended to listen to that intuition and go, that's interesting. This feels right. Or it doesn't feel right. Why am I feeling like that? I very quickly tried to get a rational kind of analytic handle on it and then move forward from that. But certainly I'm a fan of having intuition play a key role in your life. It doesn't mean you always follow it.
A minor piece of bad luck in the library when you were a boy led to major good luck for you in your life, didn't it?
Yeah, the reason why I got into magic in the first place is I was in a library and stumbled across some magic books and essentially went to the wrong section of the library and got very excited about magic. And I think that's a good example that you know, it's easy to go, oh, I'm in the wrong section of the library, I'm trying to find another section and so on, versus pausing and go, oh, this is interesting. In fact, it's more interesting than the thing I came in to look for. And let me follow that path. And it turned out to be probably the most important decision in my entire life. And that is so often the case. You know, we like to think we're in control of our lives and it's big decisions that are going to have a big impact. And you know what? It's going to a party and bumping into somebody. It's going left instead of right in the street. And because of that, X, Y, and Z happens. It's the odd comment at work, which means a colleague goes, oh, I didn't realize that. And suddenly, you know, as I say, everything flows from that. Yeah. So I think that sort of intuitively, we know that chance is incredibly important, that luck is important. And it's why we do all those superstitious rituals. You know, even the most skeptical of us touch wood or cross our fingers or whatever it is. That's an attempt to get that chance, that sense of chance, on our side. And we know it's irrational, but we still do it anyway. And I think that's why the notion of luck has really survived over time in pretty much every culture. And the idea of luck school, as it were, of you know, genuinely changing the luck is so appealing to people.
Speaking of the workplace, can businesses change their luck? I don't know what happened with this research of yours, but you were embarking on looking at this at one stage, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I became fascinated by the kind of principles of luck, but at a group level. So, for example, we found out that if you take a group of people that don't consider themselves particularly lucky or unlucky, it takes about one or two lucky people in the room to get them to feel more buoyant. It only takes one unlucky person to bring everyone down. So, unfortunately, negative emotions are more contagious than negative thinking than positive. And so I was interested in how that played out in the workplace, and we would do luck school with entire organizations, and you could see that sense of change. Because I think groups of people, you know, become essentially as one. And so they start to get an impression of whether their organization is lucky or unlucky. And it's not really to do with any particular individual working for it. Often it can be to do with the CEO or the person in charge. But it's that sense of, you know, is this a lucky organization? And so by going in and changing the mindset of staff, you change the bottom line profits of the organization. So that was fascinating work.
Your work in the old days looked at people who consider themselves unlucky, and they literally, just to get back to this for a minute, didn't see things. You experimented once with a group of people who considered themselves lucky or unlucky. You arranged to meet them at a pub. And what happened then, please, if you remember that example, and what did it tell you?
We've done a few of those studies, so I think it was about observation. So on some of them, we would put sort of scratch cards or lottery tickets, sometimes even cash, on the way to the meeting place. And the lucky people tended to spot those. The unlucky ones didn't. We had another version where we asked them to look through a newspaper and count the number of photographs in there. And we put in a huge advert saying, you know, tell the experimenter you've seen this advert and win £100 or whatever it was. And again, you know, the lucky people tended to spot that. The unlucky ones didn't. In some of the experiments in cafes and pubs, we would put somebody who was extraordinarily wealthy into the place, and they were sitting on their own on the table, and we'd see who struck up a conversation with that person, and it tended to be the lucky people and not the unlucky people. And so, of course, if you walk past those opportunities or you don't have those conversations, you don't realize what might have happened in your life. And so that was fascinating to see how people's beliefs and behavior impacted in a very real way on how lucky they were.
And I remember one of your sentences, something you wrote a long time ago: the world offers you largely what goes on in your mind. And we hear about confirmation bias. It just doesn't just apply to our politics or whether we're an anti-vaxxer or whatever. It actually applies to the way we shape our lives, doesn't it?
You know, in social media, we tend to follow people that agree with us because we don't like disconfirming information. And of course, once you have a belief or any sense of self-identity of who you are, you then look for information that confirms that. So once you start to believe you're a lucky person, when things go well, that's what you focus on. Things that don't go so well, you tend to take them out of your mind. Exactly the opposite if you're an unlucky person. So yes, it's not like these beliefs that we have are open to rational analysis. You know, we like to think that we are correct, and we look for confirming information. And sometimes that can be our friend if it makes us feel good about who we are, and sometimes it can be our enemy if we don't feel so good, and yet we see confirmation all the time that that's the case. So it's again absolutely fascinating. As you say, it goes way beyond, you know, just political or other types of belief. It goes into who we think we are.
It's interesting, like magic, it can sometimes be the tiny tips and tricks that are useful. Like if you want to increase your chances, I'm thinking of tidbits from your book, 59 Seconds Now. And if you want to increase your chances of making a good impression in a meeting, sit towards the middle of the table, little things you can do like that. That there are all sorts of strange things that can make a difference in your life. They're quite small.
Again, I mean, the 59 Seconds book followed on from Luck Factor. And that came about because I went to see a friend of mine, a very successful CEO. And she wasn't feeling very happy. And she said, well, you understand about the psychology of happiness. Can you tell me how to be happier? So I started to explain some of the theories, and she looked a bit bored and said, well, I'm a bit busy. Can you speed things up a bit? I said, how long have you got? And she said, well, about a minute. And I thought, well, what can I tell you about happiness in a minute? And I thought, actually, there are some things I can tell you that make you feel a bit better and so on. And then that, again, a chance conversation, essentially, became 59 seconds, which is all the things you can learn in less than a minute in terms of motivation and so on. And yes, you're right, it's a little bit like magic, because it's got all this little sort of mind hacks in there. So that notion that when you look at a photograph, it tends to be the most important people that are in the center of the photograph, if there's a group of people in the image. And so if you go through your own Facebook pictures or wherever they are, you can see where you sit in terms of the group. And sometimes it can be a bit depressing, but still, you get some insight. And the reverse is true. That if you want to make an impact in a meeting, being in the middle of the table rather than the ends actually makes you seem as more intelligent and persuasive and so on. So there's all the quick things that you could do. Yeah, if you want to cheer yourself up, actually forcing your face into a smile for about 30 seconds, very, very effective at increasing mood. So, yeah, so simple things like that that have a very big impact.
To increase the likelihood of someone liking you, get them to do you a favour. When you gossip... When you gossip about another person, and this is fascinating, isn't it? Listeners unconsciously associate you with the characteristics you are describing, and those characteristics are transferred to you when you gossip.
Yes, I love that. I mean, I actually, because no one enjoys good gossip more than my good self, but I actually stopped doing it when I read that research, because what happens is, you know, you're gossiping about somebody else, but exactly as you say, the person that you're talking to transfers those traits to you, because afterwards they think, well, that's where I last heard those words. So it's not a great thing to be doing. So yeah, it's all those little sort of tricks that are all kind of fun. I mean, just surrounding yourself with greenery, you know, putting a plant in the office increases productivity, increases well-being. We're now starting to see more and more on the impact of nature, spending time in nature, even the color green making people feel good. So yeah, it's about, I mean, maybe because I've got quite a short attention span, it's about, you know, the quick stuff that has a big impact.
I could ask you about the quick stuff all day, but I know we've taken up quite a bit of your time. One more thing. Research shows people with surnames, and we've probably all heard this, beginning with a letter towards the start of the alphabet are more successful in life than those with names towards the end. Would there really be such an effect, you know, from teachers reading out their names first in class when there were children, Richard?
Well, somebody who's called Wiseman, I can tell you that was my experience growing up. I don't know what happens in schools at the moment. But yeah, whenever we had to line up, we had to do it alphabetically. And whenever we went through a register. So I got very, very used to being at pretty much the bottom of every single list that I encountered. And that has an impact. So if you look at science, for example, people whose surname is towards the start of the alphabet tend to be more successful in academia than those towards the bottom. I'd like to think I've bucked that trend, but who knows? And also, it's not only that, it's your name as well. You know, if you have a positive set of initials that spell a positive word like ace, for example, or something like that, you do well than those than other people. With a surname like Wiseman, being in academia, maybe there's been some unconscious kind of biasing going on there as well. So it's all those things which, you know, make life interesting and fun, and that psychology can give us some kind of insight into.
One last thing. We've got a nightly weather forecast, and on all our channels, I don't know what it does in the UK, but the forecast moves south down our island, starts in Auckland or Northland and moves south, as it would, say, from Glasgow to London. And in our case, it ends up in the cities of Invercargill and Dunedin. If the forecast, Richard, began at the bottom and went north on nightly TV, would it raise the morale and happiness and maybe luck of people living in the south?
Well, I mean, when you think about it, why is the map north and south? You could turn the whole country upside down. So one night you could have it one way up, and the next night you could have it the other way up. Because, you know, who's on top and who's on the bottom is just something we've made up. That's just a human construction. So, yeah, turn the entire country upside down on alternative nights. That's my advice.
Thank you very much for your time with us this morning. It's fascinating.
Pleasure. Okay, thanks very much, and thanks for inviting me.